speak up, up. Speak up, speak up, up. Speak up, speak up, speak up,
speak up,
speak up, speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories. Good morning. Welcome. How's it going? Nice. Cool. Welcome to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, the campus community radio at Simon Fraser University. We broadcast on the unceded and ancestral territory of the Halkomelem and Musqueam speaking people. My name is Jesse. Happy to be here with you this hour to present a couple bits of talk and information and interviewing, interspersed with some music and myself just rambling, as is tradition. Today on the show, we have part two of Stella's interview with Paulette Petra. If you were listening last week at this time, you would have heard the first part. If you missed that, you can always go to cgsf.ca and find the program page for Speak Up and listen to the first part of this. I mean, it will help to have heard the first part, but it's a good conversation either way, and you'll catch on. You'll catch on pretty quickly. Also, we'll hopefully be speaking with Marie from Embark about Embark and about Radfrosh and about a bunch of different things. So that's all coming up. But first, as is tradition, we're going to start with some local music. This track I'm going to play for you is by Edzu, and it comes off of her album Tunnel Vision, which was just released about a month ago, August 16th. And we are going to hear the lead single, This Love, by Edzu, right here on Speak Up.
This love
The Renfrew Ravine Moon Festival is back. Still Moon Arts Society is proud to announce the 22nd annual Renfrew Ravine Moon Festival. A fusion of art, nature, and community, this month-long festival celebrates the Harvest Moon, Still Creek, local art, and the diverse cultural traditions of the Renfrew Collingwood neighbourhood. Attendees can expect dazzling lanterns, live music, dance, food, art and nature workshops, and community performances, all including making salmon lanterns, mooncakes, and guided tours. Connect with the local nature as a community to raise awareness and bring positive change to restore Renfrew Ravine to its natural beauty. Learn more and register at stillmoonarts.ca.
Welcome back to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. I'm Jesse. You just heard Ed Ziu with a track called This Love. And now we are going to hear the main feature for today's program, which is part two of programming assistant Stella's interview with Paulette Petra, who provides some critical perspectives on colonial legislation and Indigenous resurgence. Once again, if you missed the first part, you can go to cgsf.ca and find the program page for Speak Up to find last week's installment with the first part of this conversation. But if you're missing out on that, fear not. You'll still enjoy this, and then maybe you can circle around for the beginning of the conversation later. So without further ado, I will send us there.
This is CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, community radio from Simon Fraser University.
Burnaby is located on the ancestral and stolen homelands of the Halkumalam and Squamish-speaking peoples. I'm Stella, the programming assistant at the station.
And I'm Logan. I'm in the community outreach and promotions position at the station.
And together, we'll be doing Pride programming for the summer.
So stay tuned for interviews, music, and special segments centering around queerness, veering away from our heteronormative understandings.
Welcome to the second part of a two-part interview with Paulette Petra, an influential voice from the Two-Spirit Indigenous community, bringing a critical perspective on colonial legislation and Indigenous resurgence to the airwaves. Last time, we talked about the term Two-Spirit and what it means, as well as Polly's journey as an executive director at Two Spirits in Motion Society, a grassroots organization for and by Two-Spirit peoples. Before I get into the interview, I just want to give you all Polly's definition of Two-Spirit for some context.
The way people explain it or understand it is unique to each person, mm-hmm. unique to each individual that identifies Two-Spirit. But essentially, it's an Indigenous person that comes from the 2SLGBTQIA+ community. But within every linguistic group, they have specific terms that identify with the non-binary queer folks within the community. And it's not even that concept of like having physically or metaphysically two spirits, but mm-hmm. It wasn't just a binary world. We had that understanding that different beings, different genders, different roles and responsibilities were there pre-contact. And those knowledges are slowly starting to wake up.
You can listen to last week's full episode. It will be posted on cjsf.ca under Pride Programming. But for today, we are continuing the discussion, and this segment will focus on looking 7 generations ahead and traditional Indigenous art.
I worked in the justice system for a good portion of my life, probably 10 years of my life. And I worked with youth in the justice system for a good 10 years of my life. And in those 10 years, they've shown me a lot that if they just had one person believe in them and give them a little bit of guidance, they were able to get out of the icky situations that they put themselves in. And nobody got them out of it. They got themselves out. They just needed that little bit of guidance. We all need that. I come with that at the table. And I understand not everybody has that. Try to be kind and caring and understanding. And sometimes that comes off as maybe not what people want me to be. But I was given an opportunity to use my voice at those places so I can create room for all of us to be there, because I feel like we all should be sitting at that table. I don't think I need to be the only person there. That's why when you talk with my staff, they'll say, she's really hard on you. This is the hardest boss you'll ever work for. They have high expectations. But if you want someone in your corner, that's the person you call.
Wow, that's great. You totally just answered two questions that I had written down. Two, I was going to ask, like, how do you pull from history and work done by those who came before you? And you talked about your mentors and what they taught you. And then I was also going to ask, how do you look seven generations ahead?
Seven generations mm-hmm. is 150 years. No, it's 175 years. That's a lot of time. We've only signed Treaty 4. It's going to be coming up in September 15th, 150 years. So they've thought of seven generations, six generations if you're counting it, but seven generations is 175 years. How do you make decisions that's going to help and support 175 years after you? Some people can support maybe two generations after them, mm-hmm. but how do you support and how do you think through all of those things for 175 years? That's a long time. That's a long, long time. But somebody thought of me. Somebody thought of you. And they gave you the tools to equip you to do the job that you're doing. You have been chosen to be part of that. Somebody's thought of you, made sure that the safety and well-being of who you are is the reason why you're here today. We're all gifts of 175 years prior. We're the gifts of seven generations ago. How do we translate in our time 175 years after? And you got to think of it outside of yourself. And it doesn't have to be perfectly written or perfectly done. It has to be done with the intention of supporting your community. The intention that in 175 years, they're still practicing our traditional protocols. So what do you do in that time? You make sure that you translate what knowledges you have and you transfer them to the next generation after. You equip them, you get them ready. Because I want to think that the people that I'm helping mentor, that in 40 years' time, people go to them and ask them for their perspectives and understandings. Not for me, not for them to name me, so that we have those traditions and practices and protocols and the way we do business. And the only way you heal trauma, it's going to take the same amount of time.
Yeah.
To intentionally work towards healing. So I always talk to my staff about that. How do you intentionally, the work that you are doing, how do you intentionally set forward that it's going to be impactful? You come prepared. You represent the community the best you can. Mm-hmm. And you provide opportunities for other people to sit at that table with you. You bring forward other people. You bring them up and you elevate them with you because there's enough room for all of us to succeed. We've bought into every man for themselves. That's untrue. If we were to collectively stand up together, we can rule a lot of things.
Definitely a very important thing to think about, seven generations ahead. And yeah, I haven't heard that before, but when I was doing a bit of research on you with your art and beading, I saw that was mentioned, and I just want to talk about your art and beading a little bit. So you convey Indigenous resiliency in one of your works, beautiful beaded woman's yoke. Can you describe the piece to our listeners a bit?
Sure. That was done in a residency with Sagaywalk in Regina. And it was at the time when Canada was turning 150. And they said, how do you reflect on it? what are you going to write? What are you going to make? And I've never made a woman's traditional yoke before. Never done it. That's a huge project. That's mm-hmm. like a lifetime project sometimes. And I was like, I got 6 months to create something. And so I challenged myself with this idea. What do I want? And I use cut beads. And cut beads are hard to work with because they literally cut your thread. So you have to be prepared when you work. And mm-hmm. the color scheme was very intentional. I recall it was done with canvas. And I beat it on canvas. And then I then sewn on top of that canvas to kind of do like this bias was with red. And the intention of red is like, there's a lot of blood that was spilt in order for Canada to be where it's at as a province of the Queen at the time. So I outlined it with this red bias. And then with that red bias on top of it, I outlined it with shell casings from a Glock. But was it shell? No, it was with a Smith & Wesson shell casings. So with that, it's a handgun that's used by the RCMP. Mm-hmm. Very specific, very intentional. Yeah. I went and I did my research. I was like, okay, this is what I'm going to do. Because what was used against us as a tool was the law. And when you're talking about Indigenous people 150 years ago, at the time, right, 150 years ago, that they would respect law because they respect natural law. And so this was done with force, though, brute force. There was a lot of tactics, whether it was starvation or any of those kind of ugly tactics, whether it was starvation or freezing people out or, you know, incarcerating people. There was all of these tactics used. And so I intentionally used that, those shell casings, to protect the peace, but also to show that we didn't forget that that was part of the process, that a lot of our people had to die in that process. And I remember using colors of contrary. Contrary means like, does things backwards. And we believe within our ceremonies that we have a contrary within every ceremony that we have, that they come there to correct wrongdoings that are done within our community, whether it's sickness or social harm. So I used black and white and I made this design, but I also used this pink flesh color on the sleeves. Because I feel like arms are very mobile. You can use them to gather or you can even use them for combat. And so I put that on the arms, which is this pink flesh looking color. And then I remember also having this circle. And part of that circle was on there was this image of this woman that's pregnant. And I really wanted to understand at that time, I was really thinking about the ideas of MMIW G2S plus, of how many of our people have gone missing, murdered in 150 years. And we now know that number is massive, massive, especially with 215, right? And those were conversations we were having already as community members. We knew about 215. We knew about those mass graves. We had all those stories. Nobody believed us. We weren't listened to. Because sometimes when you go into a non-Indigenous community and you tell the truth, you're crazy if you don't have any proof. And now they started to unveil these things years later. But I was thinking about it then. And I was like, nobody thinks of our, because at the time, there was this high rates of femicide. So femicide is death of women, intentional death of women. And nobody was thinking about our women-identified people as life givers. And if they did, they didn't care. Because how do you get rid of a race? You get rid of their women.
Mm-hmm.
You know? How do you disrupt their well-being? Well, you put them in an institution. They have a disconnect of how their way of life is, their governance, their mm-hmm. sovereignty. And you start disconnecting the family. So that's why I put that image of that woman on there. And to me, that was like really important. Really, really important to have her pregnant mm-hmm. on there. I can recall it beautifully. And then there was like two-spiritedness on there. And nobody was talking about it. Nobody was talking about queerness in their art. And if it was, it was like they were quoting people like Andy Warhol, but nobody was talking about two-spirit queerness.
Yeah.
You know? And I remember doing that piece. I remember coming out and talking about it. I remember having my opening and there was a couple RCMP standing there and they're like, why did you do that? And they were really offended. And I said, have you ever questioned why you're a cop? I know you could come up with an answer. It's probably lineage or some form of like selflessness that's there, but you're part of an institution, whether you want to admit it or not, that has created a lot of harm to Indigenous people. And I say that because at the F division in Regina is where they hung Louis Riel, because he was considered a rebellion and not a leader. He wasn't a form of resistance in their mind. They wrote that chapter very differently. So I would question them at that space. And I remember them being really upset with me, being very strong with my answers with them and very sharp and very concise, because they came there very calculated. And I told them that. I said, you came here very calculated in a sense that you almost want to quiet me and censor me with my art. And you want me to lie and say something completely different. I said, so you're telling me that ripping a child away from their family is for the betterment of society? That makes no sense to me. And so I had these like mm-hmm. really hard conversations with community. And here's the catch. I wanted to be a cop myself. I wanted to be a cop. I was like gung-ho for it. I was like, I am good for this. I was able to pass all of the POPAT. I was wanting to be RCMP until somebody asked me, how comfortable are you going to feel totally targeting your own communities? And I was like, ah, made me think about it, mm-hmm. you know? And I'm not saying that all police are the same or history repeats itself, but it happens a lot. It's still happening. I'm a person that will speak about a truth. Good, bad, ugly. And I'm not going to shy away from it. And I have a lot of close friends that are veterans, that are police officers, that are community members, that are elders, that are youth. And I'm able to sit in those spaces and kind of have those tough conversations that nobody wants to have. Because I think we need to start talking about things that nobody wants to talk about. You know, and I did that with art because I left people with a lot of conversation. It was really pretty to look at, but the moment they would ask questions, it was like, ooh, they were like, I feel cringy. I don't know what to say. And I had a platform to speak about those things that I was putting in question. What are we celebrating? That was before there's no pride in genocide. That was before 215. I was being radical in those kind of stances. So here I am, still doing the same stuff.
Yeah. No, that's awesome, continuing it. How do you see Indigenous resiliency's like relationship with traditional art?
I think there needs to be more of it. And there's a lot of artists. There's a lot of beating artists that aren't at the front of the there's a lot of grassroots artists that are doing amazing work, specifically in traditional art, that is very historical. And it, to me, when you're beading it, you're documenting something, whether you know it or not. I'm sure I can point at any work of art and ask somebody what was going on in your life when that was happening. And they could tell you just by looking at the piece. Or they could tell you that was a really hard piece to complete because I was making it for this person. And then you learn a little bit about them. Because there's a spiritual aspect to it, whether we want to acknowledge it or not, it's there. And it's tangible because you're making it, you're creating it so people could see it. And I think it's such a good way to combat or create conversation that is difficult to navigate through. I think the process itself needs to be spoken about more because people have different practices and processes when it comes to creating and making. And as an Indigenous artist, as a queer female-identified Indigenous artist, those spaces are widely taken up by white cisgendered males. I think we need to have more conversations questioning those spaces. And I believe everybody has beautiful art. I was talking with a young artist and they were like, I don't know if I can make these moccasins. We had like a gender affirming project. And we brought a bunch of youth together to make gender affirming regalia. And I remember this youth looking at all their materials and they just got overwhelmed and they're like, it's too much. I cannot. And I said, good. You're thinking about it. I said, sometimes it takes a long time to make something. That's part of the process. It's because you're being intentional about what you want to put down. You're not just putting things on things for the sake of doing it. There's intention behind it. And to me, people that struggle with that are real artists because it's hard to like make something, especially with intention. You know, what do you want to talk about? What do you want this piece to talk about? And when I started doing, prior to this job, I was in a master's fine arts program at OCAD University in Toronto. It was an online program. I was 4 classes away from finishing my master's, and then I was asked to sit and take this position on by elders within our community. So I had a big decision to make. But prior to that, I remember doing my work and I remember not showing people what my beadwork was. And that really changed the narrative. It was completed work. I just wouldn't show them the completed work. I would just show them the part before I turned the moccasin inside out and showed the beadwork. And I just wouldn't show them. And to me, it was about access. We don't always have to give access to what we're going to create and make, but we need to continue to do it.
Yeah.
It's important because in those conversational pieces, it will bring out different conversations. You will hit different echo chambers. And the art community is just a really strong community when they start sharing their stories of why they made certain things. Then you're starting to have that documentation. You're bringing back that resiliency. I love artwork. What I really love in the past, especially 10 years, the boom of like Indigenous artists in fashion.